Morning. I'm Sharon Leon from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. I'd like to welcome you to the first Object of History audiocast. The Object of History is a joint project of the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History to provide students and teachers around the country with a look at key objects from the collection. Our focus today is the Woolworth's lunch counter from Greensboro, North Carolina, where four young African-American college students sat down on February 1, 1960, and refused to leave until they were served. That sit-in eventually prompted the desegregation of the lunch counter in July 1960, but it also launched a movement of nonviolent direct action protest against segregation across the South. We're joined today by three guests who will answer your questions about the lunch counter, the Woolworth sit-in, and its impact on the civil rights movement. First, at the Museum of American History, Bill Yanks is the chair of the Division of Home and Community Life. He has primary responsibility for research and collecting in the area of American social history, household and family life, domestic furnishings. Bill works with collections that range from entire houses to furniture to Tupperware to toasters to toys and to firefighting objects. Yanks is the curator who actually collected the Woolworth lunch counter. He has co-curated several exhibitions at the Smithsonian, including Sitting for Justice, the Greensboro sit-ins of 1960, September 11, Bearing Witness to History, Within These Walls, American Families and Photographs, Levittown is 50 Years Old, A Visual Journey, the photographs by Lisa Law, 1964 to 1971, and After the Revolution, Everyday Life in America, 1780 to 1800. His publication, Curating the Recent Past, published in Exhibiting Dilemmas, Issues of Representation at the Smithsonian, uses the acquisition of the Woolworth's lunch counter as a prism for exploring issues surrounding documenting and collecting material from the recent past. Second, Faith Davis Ruffins is a curator of African American history and culture in the Division of Home and Community Life. She has worked as a historian and a curator at NMAH since 1981. From 1988 to 2000, she was head of the Collection of Advertising History at the Archive Center. Davis Ruffins is widely published on issues relating to African-American history in museums, historic preservation, and public history. She has worked on a number of exhibits at NMAH, including curating Ralph J. Bunch, Statesman, Activist, and Peacemaker. And she has been guest curator for the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, the Ghana Smithsonian Exhibition Project, and the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center. Third, historian Stephen Lawson is joining us from New Brunswick, New Jersey, where he's professor of American history at Rutgers State University of New Jersey. Professor Lawson is an expert on African-American politics, particularly with regard to voting rights. Since 1972, after receiving his PhD in history at Columbia University, he has taught and served as department head at the University of South Florida, Tampa, University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and he has been at Rutgers since 1998. He is currently faculty director of the Aristide Center Research Center for Undergraduates. Professor Lawson has written numerous books, including Black Ballots, Voting Rights in the South, 1944 to 1969, Running for Freedom, Civil Rights and Black Politics in America since 1941, and Civil Rights Crossroads, Nation, Community, and the Black Freedom Struggle. Also, Professor Lawson has participated as an academic advisor to the award-winning PBS television documentary History of the Civil Rights Movement, Eyes on the Prize, Parts 1 and 2. We're taking questions today from students and teachers about the Woolworth's lunch counter. You can submit questions for our guests either through the website, objectsofhistory.org, where you would go to the forum page and fill out the question form, or by email to teachers@objectofhistory.org. Welcome. We're going to begin today with some questions that we have from students, and I'd like to start with a question for Bill Yankst, and it's about the lunch counter itself and its preservation. The question we have is, was the aim in cleaning the object to make it look, quote-unquote, good as new, or were some of the signs of aging and use and that sort of thing left as part of the counter's character and uniqueness for visitors to view.
As Sharon, the National Museum of American History collects and preserves objects to create a lasting material record of the past. The reason we cleaned the counter was to remove food residue. The store in Greensboro opened in 1938, and so when we disassembled the counter, there was considerable food residue that would attract insects, which could actually damage the object. Our goal was really to preserve evidence, so we never seek to alter an object in any way, but to really just preserve it.
Very good. That points, Bill, to the status of the lunch counter as an object in everyday life. Hence, you know, it would be important for us to examine the sit-ins and their impact on that community. I'm wondering, Faith, can you tell us whether, we have a question here about whether or not the sit-in in Greensboro was the first sit-in against sort of discrimination in public life?
Far from it. There are a number of communities. Topeka, Kansas is one that would like to claim having the first sit-in. It might be impossible to determine really when the first sit-in occurred, because even in the 19th century, in the late 1800s, there were people who were protesting the transportation segregation laws that started in southern cities, and people conducted activities that they didn't call sit-ins, but in fact were people sitting in trolley cars and streetcars protesting the beginning of Jim Crow segregation. So it's impossible to know when the first sit-in occurred. An important group of sit-ins occurred in Chicago in the late 1940s, organized against Woolworth and other similar kinds of stores by a group called the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which was an activist organization that started in the late 30s and continued work into the 40s and becomes one of the root groups for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. What makes the Greensboro sit-in, what gives it its iconic status, might be a way of putting it, is two things, I would say. Many earlier sit-ins, because of technology, were not filmed. They weren't on television. You couldn't see anything about them, and they had more of a local impact, in part for that reason, because it's not the same to read about something as it is to see it on television. But secondly, because of the specific circumstances, young college students joined by other college students who sat in Greensboro in February 1960, it led very directly to the formation of a distinctive civil rights organization, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was run by young people. And that whole aspect of the direct action wing of the civil rights movement was significantly impacted by this growing group of young people who were not ministers and who were not, in most cases, adult members of communities, but were using their youthful energy and activity to try and make changes. So those are a couple of reasons why Greensboro gets so much attention.
Excellent. Yes, Stephen, I was wondering if, you know, following on Faith's answer there, if we could, if you could place for us Greensboro sort of in the larger trajectory of the civil rights movement, and, you know, how you as a scholar of African American politics see the Greensboro sit-in as, is this a turning point? Is this, you know, sort of the events that lots of people point to as the beginning of the civil rights movement? They like to think about the Montgomery bus boycott, and they like to think about the Brown decision. Can you situate Greensboro for us?
I'll try. There are really many turning points in what I would call the modern civil rights movement. as distinguished from a much longer black freedom struggle that does go back probably to the beginnings of slavery in this country. Greensboro was important, largely because it marked the entry into the movement of large numbers of young people, black and white. And unlike some of the earlier sit-ins that preceded it, and there were a group of sit-ins between 1958 and 1960 in places like Oklahoma City and Wichita and Louisville and Miami, but in effect those sit-ins didn't take off. The Greensboro sit-ins actually stimulated basically hundreds of sit-ins throughout the South, generally along the lines of African-American colleges. I mean, one of the interesting phenomenon of this escalation of sit-ins is that the word traveled fairly quickly, not only because of media, but because during college sporting events and so forth, basketball games, groups of students would talk to the other groups about what had happened, and word spread. So Greensboro immediately led to sit-ins in North Carolina, Durham being one of them, spread through South Carolina into Florida, into Virginia. It just took off. So in that sense, Greensboro is an infusion in what had become a fairly slow-paced civil rights movement, if you think about it. I personally date the origins of the modern civil rights movement in World War II, but that would take a lot of time to discuss. But if you take Brown versus the Board of Education, that was extremely important, but you don't really get desegregation of schools in the South for the next 15, 20 years. It takes a lot more than Brown to do it. Montgomery bus boycott, which really was a way of starting grassroots mass mobilization, in a way was only partly direct action because in and of itself it was a boycott. People were removing themselves from the objects they wanted to enter. And Martin Luther King, who reached great heights as a result of the Montgomery bus boycott and founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, he did want to initiate nonviolent civil disobedience, direct action campaigns throughout the South, and workshops were held in a number of places, but really nothing much happened. There was a couple of bus boycotts after Montgomery, but one historian has referred to the years from 57 to 60 and King's relationship to it as the fallow years, not really very much. And it was 1960 and the student sit-ins that generated the great deal of activity that would come. In fact, King would spend the next couple of years trying to catch up to a number of the innovations that were instituted by student groups like SNCC and the Congress of Racial Equality Corps.
Interesting. We have actually a number of great questions here from students specifically about the sit-ins themselves. We have a question here from Indiana where a student wants to know whether all of the participants in the sit-ins were college students, and additionally, were they all African-American? Faith, can you help us with that?
All of the participants, you're talking about the Greensboro sit-in.
The Greensboro sit-in, yes.
Specifically. There were people who joined the sit-ins after the college students started it who weren't college students, but the lead was taken by successive groups of students. You know, they had sort of they were sort of doing a relay. Everyone couldn't sit in all day every day, but people would come to sit in. The most and all of the students were not African American. The majority were African American, but there were students from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, which at that time was the women's teaching college of the North Carolina system, who, for example, joined the sit-in, who were white students, white women students. So there were other people who were not college students, and there were other people who were not African American. But the majority of the people in this particular sit-in were African American, and certainly the leaders and the most stalwart of the people were college students.
Interesting. We have on the website.
Could I add one thing to that?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's significant in Greensboro when you look at Greensboro as a city, and a lot of these demonstrations that take place in the South often are referred to as spontaneous. You know, Rosa Parks and the bus boycott,
mm-hmm.
and the four African American students who went into Greensboro on February 1st. And in one sense, you know, they are spontaneous in that, you know, Rosa Parks didn't wake up that day and say, I'm going to start a bus boycott. The four black students, they knew what they were going to do, but it comes within a context of institutions in the cities that these places, these demonstrations take place, so that in Greensboro there's not only North Carolina A&T, Agricultural and Technical School, which is a predominantly historically black university. There's also a high school called Dudley High School that had a number of prominent African-American teachers who actually encouraged students to pursue citizenship, to study politics, to become full citizens and so forth. And so Dudley also, as an all-black school, did provide. The local NAACP in Greensboro had a youth council, as most of the NAACP chapters did throughout the country, and it was the youth council. In fact, two of the four of the original sit-in people belonged to the NAACP youth council. Three of the four came from Greensboro itself. There were black ministers. The Shiloh Baptist Church in Greensboro was an important institution. It was pastored by a minister named Reverend Otis Hairston, who was an outspoken critic of white supremacy. And finally, actually, unlike most other southern towns, Greensboro had elected a black elected official to the city council and the board of education. So there was a longer history in some of the more prominent cities, like Greensboro, that provided a backdrop for, you know, students to be encouraged and to be supported when they took these actions. So I think that's one of the reasons why Greensboro, like Nashville, becomes a major civil rights center.
Those are really excellent points. It's crucial, I would agree, to point to the larger milieu of organizing and activism, because the myth of spontaneity needs to be elaborated, needs to be made more complex so that people can see how political action takes place, local political action takes place.
Very, very important. Both of those answers situate the lunch counter and the sit-ins, you know, in the heart of the history of Greensboro. And we have a question here that I'd like to direct to Bill about sort of the trickiness of taking the counter from Greensboro and bringing it to the museum. I have a question here from a student actually in Atlanta who wants to know sort of how the museum convinced the folks of Greensboro to let you have a piece of this iconic lunch counter.
The acquisition of the counter was really a collaborative process, both with colleagues here at the museum, certainly with officials at the Woolworth Corporation. When I initially contacted their corporate vice president in New York, he agreed to, in principle, to donate a portion of the counter to the Smithsonian, providing we had the support of the community of Greensboro. What that required was that a colleague, Lonnie Bunch, who is now director of the National African American Museum, and I flew down to Greensboro, met with some city officials, and had a conversation about the importance of the lunch counter, the sit-in, in terms of local history, regional history, but also its national significance. They agreed, and I think everyone felt that this was really a story of national significance that was important to tell at the Smithsonian. What we do, we essentially do public history with material culture, narrative, and pictures, and we create exhibitions that are informed by history that is shaped by scholarship and research as well as changing perspectives and concerns. And what that means is that we really have, as curators, we have the power to save or forget a people's culture. We have the power to shape memory, and curators have this incredible power of choice. And it's something that, you know, we have the task of selecting objects and developing interpretations that help people understand the past.
That's great.
I was going to ask you to sort of expand
on that.
Well, the expansion that I would make is that at the time that Bill Yingst and Lonnie Bunch were working on getting the portion of the counter to the museum, the Woolworth Corporation essentially still owned the site. And people in Greensboro were, I imagine, happy to have a portion come to the Smithsonian to make their to be part of the national collections, which are saved in perpetuity. Interestingly, this process helped jumpstart in Greensboro the formation of a new museum, which is now called the International Museum of African American History and Culture, so that the Woolworth site itself now is designated as a historic building in Greensboro, and this museum, which is preserving the site and preparing interpretive exhibitions that will focus not only on the sit-in in 1960, but Greensboro and that region's larger contribution to the history of civil rights in the United States and the history of race relations in that part of the South. So that this effort helped people in Greensboro who wanted to establish an African American museum kind of get started on that project, and now there is an entity which is not yet open to the public, but they are hard at work, and my understanding is in the next year they're going to open their own museum to the public that will include a significant portion of the lunch counter that remains in Greensboro and the building itself, the Woolworth building itself.
Let me just add or clarify that we did not collect the entire lunch counter. The counter originally ran the entire length of the store and across the back wall. It seated 69 individuals. We took just a small portion of the counter and four stools, along with some of the material from behind the counter where the workers prepared and served the food. So we have things like the mirrors and part of the soda fountain and so on. But we work collaboratively with the folks who were developing this site. It was called Sit-In Movement Incorporated at that point. And they were planning to remove this particular section of the counter anyway. So it worked out very well that we were able to take this small 8-foot section without disturbing the remainder of the counter.
Very good. I was just going to say we have a number of questions about that, about the process of selecting that portion and actually extracting it. But I didn't mean to interrupt you. Was that you, Stephen?
Yes, it was. I was just going to offer a personal reminiscence, if that's okay.
Yeah,
not about the
certainly.
Original sit-ins, because I wasn't in Greensboro in 1960, but I was in Greensboro in 1992. That's when I came to Greensboro. And one of the first things I did was to go downtown and look for the Woolworth, which was still open and doing business at that time. And you know, as anyone would know, that this was an iconic site. I'm not sure what would be equivalent for someone in another field, but this was just something that I had wanted to see since I studied civil rights. I hadn't been to Greensboro before. I don't know that today's students probably don't understand exactly, you know, what a place like Woolworth's was, or Cress, which was the other place that pretty much was like Woolworth, these five and dime stores, as they called them. I guess today they'd be equivalent to a dollar store, except that it was more than just a place where you sold commodities in the downtown area. This was a place where people went in to buy a variety of items, but also to eat.
Right.
It was actually, when I ate there in 1992, the food was pretty good. It was cheap. And this counter, as Bill points out, was enormous. It was an absolutely enormous counter that stretched over the really two, one half of the building. And you'd sit in the counter, and that's the way most, you know, most people in downtown Greensboro who work there would get their lunches in Cress or Woolworth's. They do some shopping at the same time. I was trying to think what it would be like. In a way, it's not quite like this. It'd be like going to the mall and having a food court, although I'm not sure that's exactly the way it is, because it was one enormous store that you'd have. And in this one store, African Americans could buy items in that store. You know, they would take the checkout counter, they would take their cash, but what they couldn't do was to eat at the lunch counter. That's where the problem became. That's where it's probably hard for people to understand today. Well, how could you buy, you know, five notions in the store, whatever they were selling, and not be able to eat at the lunch counter? If they're willing to take your money for one thing, why not the other? And that answer is a complicated answer. But I did see Greensboro before they removed the piece, and I was there when they were trying to create the museum. I have to say it was a little bumpy initially.
Museum development often
money,
is.
Yeah, it was very bumpy because they had to raise, from what I remember, they had to raise the money themselves pretty much
to set up the museum. They've raised some millions now.
Right,
which is
good. I'm glad to hear that.
Fascinating process.
I just want to follow up on something that Stephen brought up here, and that's how people use objects to construct and maintain culturally defined relationships. And the lunch counter in this Woolworth store was part of this larger system of laws and expectations that really created two separate worlds, one for African Americans and one for Caucasian Americans. And it was, this lunch counter was used really as a physical barrier, if you will, to equality.
Absolutely. Just to follow on what Bill is saying, it's important, I think, to understand that Black people could buy stuff in the store, and they worked in the store. Indeed, they worked behind the lunch counter, cooking food and serving food, but they couldn't sit at the lunch counter and eat. And even though there were, we often describe in talking about this time the notion that there were separate worlds for Black and white people and other people, but that's a little more, these worlds were not entirely separate, and that's part of where the tension lies, is that these worlds were in fact intermingled in very complex ways, but there were taboos about what you could and could not do. And those taboos were communicated to people when they were children. So if you were a Black child, you would see that your parents could come in and buy things at the Woolworth counter, and you, maybe even your aunt or your mother or your grandmother worked behind the counter, but you couldn't sit and have an ice cream sundae and twirl around on the seat. And if you were a white child, you were definitely taught that you not only could come to the seat, come to the Woolworth counter and sit down and enjoy a malted milk or something, but that you were a superior to the African-American adults who were serving you. That this Woolworth store was a little microcosm of this extraordinarily complicated world where there were invisible lines of social belief. And if you cross those lines, you could be subject to violence. You could be subject to violence.
We have a number of wonderful questions here from students sort of about Jim Crow segregation and its roots and really how it worked. And one of the, let's start, we've got a question from St. Louis, Missouri, which sort of gets at the heart of what you're beginning to talk about here, Faith. And that is the question about whether public places were segregated before the landmark Plessy versus Ferguson decision, or is that sort of, does that decision encourage further segregation? I was wondering, maybe Stephen, you could speak to that.
Yeah. Well, they were. Segregation didn't begin with Plessy versus Ferguson, but something did happen in the South after cases like Plessy. I mean, this has been a long historical debate that's taken place about when did segregation begin, and we don't need to go into all of that. But let's say that certainly, you know, after the Civil War, even during Reconstruction, you did have segregation, but you also had the possibilities of people sharing the same public facilities. Segregation wasn't rigid in the way in which it became after Plessy versus Ferguson. In one level, we know we must have had some segregation in the 1870s because Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1875,
right,
which attempted to outlaw discrimination in public accommodations. So one should assume if they saw the need to pass the law, there must have been a problem.
Right.
But the Supreme Court in 1883 declared that law unconstitutional, said it couldn't be done. And I would say in the 1880s, early 90s, you would have a greater chance, for instance, probably to ride on a railroad car. You know, the railroads didn't want to lose money. They wanted passengers. I think, as well, class was an important factor here as well. You know, you might have the ability to go into a restaurant or an opera house or some other facility, but if you didn't have the money, you weren't going to go. But there was no question. There was segregation, but it wasn't as rigid as it became in the late, and it wasn't even as extensive as the South after the 1890s developed new ways and new venues of employing segregation so that there would be segregated cemeteries.
Right.
There would be segregated Bibles if you had to testify
right.
in court.
Right.
You would have separate Bibles to put your hand on. I mean, but that's not so much the case before Plessy. And what I should say about Plessy, so people know this, it wasn't about schools. Plessy didn't segregate the schools. Plessy provided the precedent for segregation, but it was the railroad trains.
Mm-hmm. Very good. We also have some questions about that I think are really interesting because the site lists a number of Jim Crow laws. We have a fascinating question from Chicago that says, if segregation was meant to discriminate against African Americans, why were Japanese and Chinese people included in some of the Jim Crow laws that are on the site? Faith, perhaps you could respond to that question?
Well, the short answer I would give to that is that segregation was a way of organizing what was seen as racial diversity within the United States. And therefore, it impacted everyone. African Americans were the largest minority group at that time and had a distinctive history within the South, and the Civil War had in part been fought over slavery and the emancipation of the larger number of African Americans, but there were people of Hispanic descent, Japanese and Chinese Americans, as well as Native Americans, who in different regions were different regions and different cities were the majority or significant minority population within that region. So segregation actually impacted everyone who was in the United States, because only if you were, you would only have total access to everything in the United States if you were a white person of, frankly, a particular class, which Stephen mentioned and more could be said about. But if you were a Native American child, in North or South Dakota, or if you were a Mexican American child in South Texas, you were very likely going to go to a segregated school. You were very likely not going to be able to use all the same public facilities. You would have to sit in special areas, or maybe not be allowed to have inside facilities. You would be restricted in many of the same ways that African Americans were going to be restricted. So segregation really impacted all of the United States, either by law or by custom. And it wasn't just African Americans for whom this system was set up. It was a way of orchestrating or making hierarchical a notion about race in the United States.
Thank you for making that clear. I'm sure that could have been confusing for some students. We have another sort of question about the process of nonviolent protest. But before I get to that, there's a question for Bill here. And a student wants to know about the four students who participated in the sit-ins. Did they have did you run into them in the process of collecting the lunch counter?
We did. As a matter of fact, we were very fortunate to have the three surviving men come here to the museum and participate in a public program. And we were able to meet them, interview them, and have them share their stories with our audiences here at the museum. One thing to consider when working with the recent past is that these objects are often linked to living sources, and that many of these individuals want to be consulted about their history. We have to remember that some of these individuals were arrested and jailed, and others threatened, and some affected economically and certainly emotionally. And so I felt that it was imperative that we be responsible and seek them out as sources and listen to them and really use the object, the lunch counter, as a bridge to not only the four individuals, but to the community, larger community of Greensboro and other people in the African-American civil rights movement.
That's a great segue to our next question, pointing to the fact that this is continuing and living history. We have a question actually that's just come in off the website, referring to the Little Rock School District and their release recently from the federal supervision about desegregation. And the question is sort of, what is the status of segregation and desegregation today? Maybe you can start on that for us, Stephen?
Well,
that's
publicly,
a big question.
Yes, I mean, it's a huge question. But
yeah, I mean, Little Rock in many ways is one of the success stories, as I understand it. I think the school, Central High School, is a nationally recognized school for good education. It's been integrated education. It's persevered over these now five decades, and it is a success. We'd have to break it down. In terms of public accommodations, which is what the Greensboro lunch counter was all about. You know, publicly, legally, there is no bar to going in to any, you know, place that serves the public and getting a meal or being treated equally. You can't discriminate, you know, by race. What some places did after 1964, when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, which in effect made illegal not just segregation in places like Woolworths, but in restaurants and hotels and so forth. It made sure that legally you couldn't do it, discriminate, but there were resistors who formed private clubs, which they argued they could invite anyone that they want. And same thing happened with attempts to avoid desegregation of public schools. Private schools were set up, charter schools were set up to avoid desegregation. So there remains a ways to avoid at least legal desegregation by setting up private groups in which you could keep those who you didn't want to serve in that area. But by and large, if you look at, you know, if Rip Van Winkle had gone to sleep in 1945 and then awakened today, he would be astounded by what he would see in terms of the ability of minority people to go into restaurants and public accommodations and so forth and be treated equally. But it's hardly perfect. I mean, the schools are glaring example of that. Brown versus the Board of Education and its successes are glaring examples. There are certain places in this country we probably have more segregation in the schools, generally the larger cities, in which we've had white flight from those cities, and there are very few people of mix of different races to integrate in these schools. It's not just the South. In fact, I don't know if this is still the case. It probably is, but the South may have more school integration than the North does. Chicago, for instance, is one of the most segregated school systems in the country. It's not by law, but basically it's de facto segregation generated by housing patterns, which I would argue also reflect racism and racist practices, but nonetheless, the courts haven't ruled that. And what blocks desegregation of school systems is the fact that the Supreme Court says that you can't bus kids from one school district to another, from the inner cities to the suburbs and vice versa. So by and large, in the kinds of things Greensboro was all about, we have a pretty good record, but we are still an informally segregated society in the school systems. And probably, you know, after before 9 o'clock and after 5 o'clock, and probably Martin Luther King used to say that the most segregated hour in America was 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning in church. And although there are examples of integrated churches, still religiously people are separated, not by law, but by customs, practices, and so forth.
We've only got a couple of minutes left yet, but Faith, would you care to comment or expand on that?
Yes, I thought that was a wonderful summary. I would reinforce the notion that residential segregation mm-hmm. by neighborhood, which has something to do with class and one's ability to get a mortgage in a certain area. Stephen pointed out that there have been racist bank practices and other efforts which have kept certain neighborhoods far less diverse than they might otherwise be. However, I would just say as a personal note that my childhood, the United States that I experienced as a child, and I was born in 1954, and today is astonishingly different. I remember that it was always a question, okay, if you were going to go someplace, would it, not only would they take black people, would it be a comfortable or pleasant experience to go there, or was there going to be the possibility of something really nasty happening if you were to go to a particular restaurant or go to a particular theater or something like that. And that now really you don't really think about, nowhere near on the same level. So that there's an old saying that, you know, we haven't gotten where we really want to go, but we're a lot further along than we used to be.
Well, that's an excellent note for us to end on, and I want to thank Bill Yanks, Faith Davis Ruffins, and Stephen Lawson for their time and their wonderfully insightful answers today. We've discussed a lot of fascinating topics related to the lunch counter. A reminder for our listeners, we'll be back to answer more questions on this topic at 10:10 Eastern Time next Friday, March 9th, so we can give more students the opportunity to question our experts. Finally, a look ahead. The featured object for the month of April is a short-handled hoe owned and used in the fields of the Southwest by members of Cesar Chavez's family. Materials related to the short-handled hoe, the Bracero Guest Worker Program, Cesar Chavez, and the farm worker movement will be available on the website next week. And then, as I said, we'll have more live audio casts in April to discuss the hoe. Thank you for joining us and exploring the object of history.
Thank you.